This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the DRF Players Podcast. This is show 234, the May 3rd, 2017 edition, the Oaks Day preview. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, joined today, as always, not calling in from Planet Texas, but I believe on the grounds at Churchill Downs, the People's Champion, Jonathan Kinchin. JK, am I correct about your whereabouts?
You are. I was on the grounds. I am off of the grounds now, but I was there this morning to take it all in and from the backside for the first time, which was pretty cool. So it's upon us. Derby week is upon us.
I saw a picture of you with a stopwatch. Was John the Clocker actually putting you to work today out there, timing some horses, or are you just a big poser?
I'm a poser. He said, he goes, hey, hold this for me real quick. And I was like, all right. I held it. Then he took a picture. And next thing you know, my group chat's blowing up of people making fun of me thinking that I'm a clocker now. So they won't be laughing when I cash tickets on the set that I watched work this morning.
That's fantastic. We'll be talking more about that as the show goes on. We have a very special guest I want to introduce today. He is the president of Glen Hill Farm. He's also an accomplished contest player and just a horse player in general, part of the ever-growing intersection of folks on the breeding and ownership side of this game and the horse player side of the game. He's Craig Burnett. Craig, how are you doing today?
Great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for taking time out of your busy day. Before we get down to the brass tacks of handicapping a little bit of this Oaks Day card, Craig, I wanted to hear a little bit about your background. We talk all the time in horse racing about breeding and the way that that mothers and fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers shape the racing that we see on the track. But you're an example of how that can happen behind the scenes as well. Talk to me about the history a little bit of Glen Hill Farm.
So the farm, I'm 39, but the farm's been around for 50 years. My grandparents from Chicago, my grandfather grew up going to the races, and his dream, if he were ever in a position to do it, was always to start a racing and breeding operation. So I grew up, luckily, you know, with my family having horses. We came down to the farm in Ocala on school holidays. I was very close with my grandfather. He really taught me the breeding and racing side. And my grandmother, she was a CPA, and was a numbers person, and she would get a hold of the form, and she was a really good handicapper. So that's kind of where my handicapping came from. And I'm in the horse business full time, but having grown up in Chicago in the suburbs, you know, I didn't grow up on the farm around horses every day. So, it was the racing form was the way I, you know, kind of learned the game along with sales catalogs and kind of came to the horse part of it third, which is a little different from a lot of people in the horse business. But I have a long background kind of in trying to bet on horses, and that's part of the way that I learned the business for sure.
Craig, I've often, you know, got to talk with you in you know, private situations about, you know, you're a big advocate for the horse player, and I've always found it interesting because I think a lot of times in this sport, there's like, we kind of get divided into two different sections. There's the owners who think that this is how things should go for the game to excel, and then there's the horse players who feel like this is how things should go, and you happen to be both of those. Talk to us a little bit about kind of your stance on the game and how horse players fit into that puzzle and their importance to allowing the game to continue to thrive.
Well, you know, if you really think about it and take a step back, the only people involved in the horse business that really have a choice in it are horse players and horse owners. We're the people that, you know, decide whether we want to invest our money or not. There's a lot of people that make their living off of the horse business. There's every trainer, jockey, every exercise rider, every backstretch worker, everybody that works on a farm, everybody that works at a sales consignment, everybody that works at a racetrack, everybody that drives a van, everybody that's a blacksmith, everybody that works at a vet clinic. All of them really depend on horse players betting their money, and they depend on owners paying their bills. And I really think the sport needs to do a better job of really trying to make sure that both of those stakeholders essentially have the best experience possible. I think on any issue, horse players and horse owners would likely agree on 95% of any issue, because, you know, the more transparency there is in the business, the more comfortable people are going to be investing on the buying side, and I would think the more comfortable they're going to be wagering. So, you know, I really think that our interests are often aligned. The racetrack has essentially two customers, the guy who gambles and the guy who owns horses, and they sometimes, to be honest, try to divide the horse owner and the horse gambler, but I really think the horse player and the horse owner have almost everything, you know, that I can think of in common. But I would tell you 90% of horse owners I know, you know, they don't really understand the horse player side of it, and the same goes to it with most of the horse players I know. You know, they don't really understand the horse owner side of it. So I think both sides can really use some education and information, because their interests, you know, I think would be pretty similar on most issues.
I know that just from the knowledge I have that I've gained from friends and in my own limited participation in the ownership side of the business has helped me immensely as a horse player. We'll have to have you back here, Craig, another time. We could do a whole hour, I would think, sort of a primer for each group on the other's interests, and talk way in depth about the areas where horse players and horse owners could be aligned a bit more. I love that idea as a future topic of discussion. Before we get into the Oaks Day card, I also want to talk to you a little bit about contest play. And I hope I'm not bringing up a sore subject here, Craig, but here's the way I look at it. In the Breeders' Cup last year, you had the opportunity. It didn't work out, but you had the opportunity to make the greatest value bet of the entire day. I'll let you go into as much detail as you want about what I'm talking about as we entered the Breeders' Cup Classic last year at Santa Anita.
Well, you know, I was in a good position. I think I was in third or fourth place going into the last race, and I didn't have any question that I thought California Chrome was likely the best horse. I now realize that was a bad opinion, but at the time, I really thought that he was going to win that race. And in trying to figure out what the players were going to do ahead of me, I didn't think that if I bet to place, I would have won enough money to win the tournament. And I think I had about like $55,000, from my original $7,500 bankroll, but to win the tournament, you were going to have an opportunity to make about $400,000. So I thought that if I bet to place, I probably would have locked in a top five, but I thought a lot of people would go all in that race, you know, on California Chrome. So I decided to bet, like $50,000 on California Chrome to win. And if he had won, I would have gotten like $400,000 approximately, $390,000. And he was 4-5 in the race or something. So essentially I was betting, I was getting 8-1 on a 4-5 shot, and the numbers were enormous. But I had a little bit of a background playing some poker tournaments, and I kind of understood the value proposition of the live money horse racing tournaments. So, you know, in that moment, it made a lot of sense. I think, you know, 6 months later, I really wish I hadn't done that. But at the time, that was kind of the logic behind it. And, you know, I Harrogate's run a couple times since, and he's clearly a better horse. And, you know, when he won the Travers, I didn't really believe that was a real number. Nyquist, Exaggerator, they were the best horses of the crop. They didn't really run well. The horses that were second and third, you know, the Gary West horse and Gunrunner, you know, they hadn't been winners of Triple Crown races. The Gary West horse was second in the Haskell. So I just didn't think that, I just didn't trust that race. So that's why I picked California Chrome, and obviously it didn't work out.
It's hard to remember now, but there was a very legitimate reading of Arrogate's form coming into that race that he was, as you're saying, Craig, you could look at him and say, okay, he's a one number horse. And how do we know that number is real? So I think it makes perfect sense. It's also easy to say after the fact, well, if you just put all that money to place, your win total would have exceeded the total of Joe Applebaum, the eventual winner. So there's a simplistic way of looking at it that says, okay, well, you could have won just by making the place bet. But that's not how it works in the real world. I mean, I didn't talk to everybody in the top 20, but I know, for example, Vic Stauffer was also heavily leveraged with Chrome on the win end. So I think your read was probably right. You would have been more or less guaranteed a top five finish, but that tournament to bet to place, but that tournament is so top heavy that I believe it, you know, putting the specifics of the amounts of money aside, all that stuff, just in terms of a gambling theory decision, I think it was the right move to go for it. And it just, it ended up being unlucky. And I hope it hasn't soured your taste for handicapping contests. Do you plan on getting involved in any other live bankroll events this year?
Yeah, I'm going to play the Derby betting challenge. I think that realistically, I don't think I'm as good of a handicapper as a lot of these people in the traditional, you know, win in place. You have X amount of plays over a couple days. I kind of realize that I don't have as good of a chance to beat the people who, you know, put in that much time and so on. But I think in the live money tournaments, if you're a horse player, and I know it's a lot of money, but I'm going to bet that money anyway over the weekend. I think that the added money for the that goes into the tournament pool, it makes it a natural. So I played the Derby one last year, just kind of did okay, and then took some shots late trying to get money. I've played the ones at Del Mar because we often spend the summers out there, which is like a 2-day, $6,000 tournament. And then I've played the Breeders' Cup the last few years. So I wouldn't say I'm a regular player, but you know, when I'm in town, when a tournament like that's going on, I love to play them.
You mentioned poker before. Do you still participate in poker tournaments from time to time, or is that something you just sort of did along the way?
No, I don't have the time now. I mean, I'm married and have a young family, and I travel so much for the horse business that I think if I went and tried to play poker tournaments, it would have too much effect on my marriage and my work, and those two things are way more important than a poker tournament. So that was kind of when I didn't know what I wanted to do with myself, and I didn't have a family, so unfortunately, there's not time for everything.
JK, you got one more for Craig before we start talking about this Oaks Day card?
No, I just last year I got an opportunity, and this is a great opportunity for me to bring up Divisadero again, because you know I try to do it as much as I possibly can. I saw Craig yesterday or last year for the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, walking in the hall, and he asked who I liked in the turf, and I said Divisadero, and he bet the horse, but he didn't tip me, so. hopefully we'll catch up this week and he can get me my tip.
You guys will be going head to head in that contest. It sounds like
that money was gone a race later.
It is true the way that money flows for the horse player. Well, hopefully money's going to be flowing our way on this loaded Friday card. What's going to be fun about this conversation, Craig, we can talk to you about your perspective as horse player. We can talk to you about your perspective as owner when we get a little bit later in the card to the Edgewood. But let's start off talking about the La Troyenne, the Grade 1. From what I understand, it wasn't a certainty that Finest City was even going to be entered in this race. I guess they were looking at the distaff as well. But I think when they look over the field, Connections might be pretty pleased with the way this shakes out, as she looks like she might be loose and lonely on the lead in here in the La Troyenne. Craig, when you're taking a look at a stakes race like this on a big day, what are the first things your eye is drawn to? What are you looking for, and what are your thoughts on this race specifically?
You know, that horse looks awful tough to beat, Finest City. I mean, her first time she routed, she was only, you know, she was only beat a couple lengths by Beholder and Summer Wind, and then her turf races were pretty good. And, you know, I mean, that filly looks to me like she totally towers over all the rest of the horses. So I usually, you know, when I'm looking at a race for a handicap or as a handicap, I usually look for a horse that I think can win at a price that might be a little bit hidden. But, you know, looking through this race a few times, I mean, I think any of her last six or eight races, it beats basically every horse in the race. Maybe the second choice is a possible exception, but I don't think she's in the same class. The only horse that I sort of chased a little bit last year that I think might, you know, be some hidden value is this horse Go Maggie Go. Her first three races were like outstanding in a row last year, and then she won the Black Eyed Susan, so her first four, and then she tailed off. But you know, Roman's always trains his horses at Churchill, and you know, he wins a lot of races, and almost every time he wins, it's at a price. I think that horse that might be a horse underneath, or might be a little bit of a hidden horse. But those would be the two that I'd be looking at in that race.
Go Maggie Go certainly ran huge in this race last year with a trip, and then confirmed that form with that big run in the Black Eyed Susan, like you mentioned. This is an idea I've heard thrown out there that is one of those things that might fall under the heading of fairy tale, or there might be something to it. And with your perspective as horse player and on the owning and breeding side, I'm going to just throw out the question to you. The idea that a horse like Go Maggie Go comes up against a complete and total freak like Songbird, and somehow it affects the horse mentally. The idea that they're like horrified or overmatched by such an impressive horse that it like somehow affects their confidence and sets them back and causes an issue with their form. Do you think there's anything to that idea, Craig, or is that just a story?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, the first time a horse, you know, really gets beat by a better horse when they've, you know, when they don't have an excuse, and you know, you can tell they get beat 20 lengths because they try to go with that horse for a bit and they can't, you know, they can't get by that horse, you know, and then they trail out the back. And I would say that her next race, you know, she probably was a shell of her former self. So I definitely think there's something to it. I mean, we've had I remember when I was a kid, we had a really good horse. He was kind of a late developing horse. He didn't run till he was four, but he won his first three races at Gulfstream, and then he was second in a race that's now called the Skipaway. I forget what it was called then. And then he won an allowance at Churchill. So he came in, he was like 4 for 5 with a second, and ended up being like second or third choice in the Stephen Foster the year Perfect Drift won. And he wasn't, you know, he tried and he got beat 15 lengths, and he was never the same horse. Nothing wrong with him. So, I mean, you always remember things from your own experience, but you know, when a horse steps up and they give it their all and they're not competitive, it can affect them. But, you know, and this horse had 6 months off, and, you know, I would think that she's probably okay if they're running her in grade one, first time off the bench, but it could definitely happen.
Interesting. All right, JK, you have been known to be partial to when the best looking horse on paper has a pace advantage. Is this a situation where you're going to be okay pinning your colors to Finest City's Mast, or are you going to try to get clever in the La Troyette?
Yeah, I mean, obviously she'll go forward with Mike, and Mike will, you know, that's what he does best. He stays out of horse's way, and I think that horse will be forwardly placed. And you know, like Craig said, her two-turn form is definitely something that suggests she should run here. Well, here I'm in love with Paid Up Subscriber in this spot. The horse is working well. Second time for Chad off of that the grade one Madison run going seven. Now she's back going two turns. If you look down through her form, her best race was on this track. You know, I think Chad was going to always move this horse up. It's still in the air what was going on April 8th at Keeneland on that racetrack. But I think that most people will agree you didn't want to be on the inside. She was buried down on the inside for the first part of the race, so I want to move her up off of that. So Paid Up Subscriber for me. And in fact, on my little teaser for my out of the gate this week, I'm going to do an ice cold pick three or maybe even maybe just trim it down to a double, and it's going to start with Paid Up Subscriber.
Are you kidding me? You're ice cold. You're not even going to use Finest City as a saver in your pick three?
Yeah, you know what? Someone said that to me in 2015 when I didn't use Judy the Beauty, but then that person was magically not anywhere to be found when I was cashing that ticket.
I assumed you were talking to me. I was at the house in Saratoga saying, I can't believe you didn't save with Judy the Beauty when you were down in Churchill having fun. Well, go big or go home. That's JK's attitude, and that's certainly the way to do it there.
To your point about Go Maggie Go, and you know, and Craig said it too, Dale points for Churchill races. In 2015, where I had a great day, one of the biggest blemishes of that day that really cost me from like having a, you know, even the best day I could have ever had was a Dale Roman's horse in this race, Molly Morgan, that looked like she had no shot on paper versus that field, and she won pretty easily. So I wouldn't toss Go Maggie Go just because of the way her form looks, but I also wouldn't get crazy about including her too much.
JK mentioned the out of the gate videos. They're going to be posted on drf.com. Do you know when they go up for this week? I assume you have a different schedule with the big day of Friday racing.
Yeah, I think I'm filming the Oaks Day one today, filming the Derby one tomorrow. So I'm assuming the Oaks one will come up tomorrow. Derby will come up on Friday. That's just my guess.
Seems logical. Also, the DRF Clocker report might give some key information about this race and the others we're going to be talking about. You can look for that on DRF.com this evening. Let's move on to the Ali Sheba Grade 2 going a mile and a 16th. This is a race, Jonathan. We're going to let you lead with it. I have a feeling you're going to be getting out your powdered silver wig and doing a bit of a jig. You know where I'm going with this, of course.
Yeah, you know, like on the plane when you're flying to Louisville, if you've never been to Derby, all those women are carrying around those like hat boxes. And I actually took one with me because I put my Bob Baffert wig in it, and I didn't want it to get messed up because I will have my Bob Baffert wig on for this race. American Freedom, Craig actually mentioned it earlier, was last seen running second as the bet Bob Baffert horse in the Travers, and ran second, beat Gunrunner that day, who I think most would argue is the second best dirt horse in the world. And I expect big things from him. If you hop online and watch his workout with more spirit, you'll understand where I'm coming from. I'll be ice cold here as well with American Freedom.
Before I get to your selection in the race, Craig, I want to ask you about workouts and how important they are to you from both perspectives, both as an owner and a handicapper. Have you over the years developed a sense of what to look for when examining horses as they're training in the morning?
You know, our horses generally don't work really fast in the morning. And typically when, you know, we've raced a lot in California over the years, typically when our horses are highlighted, you know, by the workout guys, it's because they're working faster than our typical horses, and you know, they'll get B plus workouts, and you know, they're usually bet pretty hard, and they're normally not the ones we like. So I kind of take them personally with a bit of a grain of salt, just because of my own personal experience. But I know a lot of trainers, they really train by the clock, and they have the walkie talkies, and they're telling the riders when to speed up, when to slow down, when to stay there. And, you know, they really train that way, and it's obviously effective. So I think that, it kind of depends on your handicapping. I typically look at the running lines, and, you know, when I have time, Breeders' Cup, maybe I'll do a little bit of, film work, but I use the workout reports mostly as a tool to understand how the horses are going to get bet more than the horses that I want to bet.
That's great. That's an excellent observation, and another way to use that information. When you can understand why certain horses are taking money, that can sometimes be of tremendous value in and of itself. How about the specifics of the Ali Sheba? Do you see it? I'm going to guess that you don't see it exactly the way that JK does as a one-horse race. Is there anyone else here who jumps off the page that you will want to be including on your tickets?
I mean, that horse is the most likely winner. He's favored. His races last year were good. If the weather reports are accurate, all his races were good, but they were good in the slop too. You know, and most of the other horses, you know, they're at their level. They're quite exposed, and they're solid horses, nice horses. I would love to have most of them, but, you know, there aren't any grade one horses in the race. And I think that American Freedom can be, one horse that, I think, you know, the one horse Birdsong, I think is a horse that should run well, especially on an off track. I like the breeding on an off track. I like his running style on an off track. I like Le Perru on forwardly placed horses because, you know, he never rushes a horse off their feet, but I like him on a horse with natural speed. And I kind of like Birdsong as well, but if the Baffert horse is as good as everybody says and as good as he ran last year, you know, I'd say he's pretty likely winner.
The only other one I'll throw in there for consideration, maybe a little bit more for second and third, but also potentially usable as a saver on the front end, though JK won't hear of it, is number two, Breaking Lucky, who I thought would benefit from a change of tactics. I don't think he'll be up in the vanguard. I think Castellano will look to settle him more along the lines of mid-pack, and he's shown the ability to finish in the past. Just one other to mention in there, and I think that's a great point, Craig, you made about how well Le Perru is suited by a horse like Birdsong and vice versa. Might be tough with American Freedom at his throat latch at a key part of the race, but it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out on the track. I was also remiss in my hosting duties. I should have mentioned the weather. Jonathan, I imagine since you're down there, you've been checking a little more regularly. It looks like there's definitely going to be rain tomorrow into tomorrow night and possibly also on Friday. How has the possibility of rain affected your handicapping to this point?
Yeah, I try not to think about it. Obviously, I am the rain bringer. El Nino. I made it rain at Del Mar. I'm just hopeful. You know, I'm hopeful that you know, obviously it's going to rain tomorrow. I'm hopeful that it maybe does a little bit of raining Friday morning, and then maybe can kind of subside a little bit. And then on Saturday, I'm just hopeful that the storm takes a little bit of a turn and we can have a clear day. The Derby experience is a good experience regardless, but it's so much better when it's fast and firm.
Absolutely. Well, the turf racing certainly likely to be affected. It seems extremely unlikely they'd be looking at coming off on a day like Friday unless things were just crazy. But the first turf race we're going to talk about is the 7th on Friday, the Turf Sprint. Jonathan, why don't we keep it with you? We'll let you lead this one off again. You have any strong opinions here?
No, we were going to have our friend Jack Jenkins on, and he pointed out a great stat that I'm going to use. I told him I'd give him credit for it. But if you're looking at pure sensation, Christophe Clement is 0-36 in the past 5 years in graded stakes in Kentucky. And so that's enough reason with a horse off of a layoff that, you know, coming out of the Breeders' Cup, this obviously isn't the spot they've been pointing to, but I'm going to lean away from him. And I'm going to give Maniacal a shot here. I'm kind of confused why he hasn't ever been on the turf. He's a Kitten's Joy. He's a half the Conquest Panthera, who I'm pretty sure is graded stakes placed on the grass. And so I'm going to give him a shot. Obviously, Wesley Ward can get a turf sprinter ready to rock and roll. They're going 5. Maniacal's got speed. Should be forwardly placed and hopefully will stick around. Nothing else in the race really got me excited. The only other horses that I kind of liked were closers, and we've talked about kind of my take on closers and turf sprints, especially going 5 furlongs at Churchill Downs. There's really not a lot of an opportunity to have any unlucky trips and still get up.
Jonathan mentioned that stat from Jack about the Clement's lack of success in stakes races in Kentucky. As an owner, Craig, is that are trainer stats something that factor into your appraisal of horses at all, or are you more focused on what's going on with the animals themselves?
See, this is why you should let me go first, because that was my pick, Maniacal. But anyway, I mean, Christophe Clement's a great trainer. He's a great turf trainer. That horse is a good turf sprinter. I remember for a long time, Bobby Franco had never won a Breeders' Cup race, oh, for his life. And then he ran 4 horses in the Breeders' Cup sprint, and the longest shot won it. And then, you know, the next couple of years, he's winning 2 or 3 a day. Trainers kind of have to run what's in the barn. And unless you're like Chad Brown, Todd Pletcher, Bob Baffert, your horses can go in waves. That's a strange stat for Christophe Clement, you know, but I don't look at them too closely. Sometimes on the first time starters, I maybe value them more than I do in graded stakes, but you know, for these type of races, if I think a guy's a good trainer, I give him credit. And if I don't really like to bet on their horses, I give the horse a little bit less credit, but the horse is most important.
For sure. My gut tells me, looking at your selection that I stole you the chance to give first, Maniacal, I feel like I'd like him, just my gut tells me, I'd like him more on firm turf than in the potential bog. Do you agree with that statement? Do you see something in his pedigree or in his PPs that make you think he'll handle a little bit of off going?
Well, you know, his race in the Amsterdam, he was favored and he was beat, but the horse that beat him obviously is a very good horse. Mind Your Biscuits, in a long time off. His last race, he showed speed and probably was a, you know, needed the race. You know, there's 2 unknowns, the turf and a softer turf. His breeding says he would like the turf and maybe should be on the turf all along. Probably would have run on turf if he had, you know, as a 2-year-old, but obviously something went amiss because he was off a year and he kept running so well on dirt. I would expect him to handle the turf no problem, and I don't have a question of his class. Usually an older horse stepping up into graded stakes, you question their class, but this horse was second to Mind Your Biscuits, who's a very good horse. The favorite is, it's hard for turf sprinters to be that dominant. Lady Shipman, this horse, but you know that horse pretty consistent, pure sensation. But I would in a 12 or 13 horse field, I would be looking for a price, especially with a favorite first time in 6 months.
Yeah, maybe Pure Sensation comes back for a reprise on the Belmont Stakes Day undercard. But yeah, you guys have convinced me. I was looking at the Maniacal anyway, and that's you're making some good cases, for him. Anything, just glancing through the pedigrees, does anything in this race, Craig, like leap out to you from a soft turf perspective, a horse who you see the sire of the dam and say, oh, well, that one will definitely move up on wet, try to maybe catch something to run in under at a price?
I don't know. I mean, all these horses have been running on turf generally for their careers. And, you know, they're mostly American bred turf horses. Our turf sprinters are better than the European turf sprinters anyway, so it's not surprising these are American horses. But we have horses that one day they like a soft turf, and then you come back and they don't like it. I mean, I have a hard time understanding when a horse is going to like a soft turf versus a firm turf. I mean, I thought Maniacal was the price, but listening to Jonathan, I would say that might be a bit of a, maybe not the greatest morning line. I think Pure Sensation is going to be over bet. I think the three horse probably will be under bet, Holding Gold. But I actually think Maniacal, I'll probably bet that horse to win. I'll probably play him in the tournament and try to key off of him, you know, in some exactas and trifectas. I really think he's the best horse in the race.
It is a good point also when you look at the difference between dirt racing and turf racing in America and how all the extra incentives that are there for owners to run on dirt if they can. I'm looking at Maniacal from that point of view, especially when he had the break as a during the two-year-old year, it makes sense that this could be what he wanted all along, and he's finally getting to do it. Be fun to see how it plays out on Friday. Let's move on to the eight bells. Craig, I won't steal your opportunity to go first this time. Do you? This is a race where I was failing to be creative as I was looking it over. Who do you think is going to win the eight bells?
I like Pretty City Dancer. I think that she's a really precocious horse, has not fared as well on the stretch out. I think she's a one turn horse. I thought she was perhaps, an Oaks horse at some point because her pedigree says, you know, she's likely to stretch out, but it didn't happen. But I think when she ran one turn, she was a super horse and she's back to it. I love her price and, that's the horse that I would pick. The other horse I think is going to run very well is Florida Fabulous. So those would be the two horses I like in the race.
Florida Fabulous possibly, making the lead in here as well to add to the attraction. JK, you and I were joking around in a text conversation this week about possible t-shirts that could be made for the DRF Players podcast. Of course, there was the obligatory "May you win all your photos." I suggested a Jonathan Kinchin "Crush Their Souls" t-shirt. Another t-shirt. I think we missed what the best-selling option would be, which is the JK "He's a One-Turn Horse" t-shirt. You obviously have strong opinions about horses and based on your history on the show of how far they want to go and how many turns they want to run. Does Pretty City Dancer fall into that category for you? Or are you with Craig? Is she a one-turn horse getting back to doing what she wants to be doing here?
Yeah, I think that her best performances will probably be around one turn. When you have a good, talented filly like that, you obviously have to try to stretch her out and see if you can get her into the gate on the first Friday in May. But, you know, I'm actually going to go with the other Cassie, and I'm actually going to throw out a head-to-head challenge to our guest, Craig Burnick. I'm going to use the other Cassie, Let It Ride Mom, and the winner gets a mint julep, courtesy of the loser.
Do you accept that challenge, Craig? That's a bold words from JK.
I think I can accept that challenge. That's fine.
So it's just rules are simple. Head to head, whichever of those two finishes first. If it's Let It Ride Mom, JK gets the julep, and I've lost my place on the other horse in the challenge here.
Pretty City Dancer
was right there in front of me the whole time. The julep goes to Mr. Burnick. I like it. Any further thoughts on that?
Nothing. No, it's not a crazy opinion. They work together. The two horses, Pretty City Dancer and Let It Ride Mom, work together. They were head and head together there. I think that at the end of the day, Let It Ride Mom's price will probably creep up a little bit higher. Live Oak, the Cassies, and Rosario won two graded stakes races at Keeneland on Bluegrass Day. I think they're going to keep that magic going across town at Churchill. I really don't have a strong opinion here, but I'm going to try to inject some value into plays with Let It Ride Mom. I guess Union Strike makes a ton of sense with the one-term form she showed in the stake at Santa Anita, and now she's second off of a significant layoff. I'm not sure what to expect from the trainer, but she seems like she's a talented filly.
We're going to anger multi-race players here by skipping over the ninth race, which is going to, of course, be a part of a lot of these late picks, including the kickoff of the late pick five. And we're going to go we're going to let Craig talk about the Edgewood, a race in which he's participating. And just curious, really curious to sort of walk in your shoes here a little bit. When you have a horse in a tough and exciting race like the Edgewood, where does your mind go as you start to look over the PPs, Craig?
You know, the horse has won two races, and then once they've run two at this time of their three-year-old year, you have to run in stakes. So, you know, we've run horses in the Edgewood and then the boys race, the American Turf. You know, most years we'll have one and one, or, you know, one or the other, sometimes in both. We've run in these races over the years and done, you know, pretty well. This horse, I don't think she's the best horse we've ever had. What I like is it took her a couple races. The dirt race first time, that she didn't run well. Her next race, she ran really green. She won. She got a break. She won again. She shipped to California. I thought it was a really funny run race. A horse scratched in the post parade, the second choice in the race. Simon Callahan trained her. And the favorite basically walked on the lead with Mike Smith. They went 114 and change. Our filly's on the lead in New Orleans, are fighting for the lead, and 112 and change. And in California, she's three lengths off of a, you know, 114 and change pace. So exact opposite of what we expected. The rider thought that if he had a chance to, you know, to re-ride the race, he would have been forwardly placed, which is how she had won. And we nominated another filly for this race, Compelled, who's going to run likely Preakness Day in their race. And this filly fits, so we thought we'd take a shot. I think it's a bit of a funny morning line because the Cassie, Oxley, Le Peru, it's all one horse. So it kind of depends which horse runs. There's some rumors that La Crenelle will run the following day against boys. If that happens, you know, all the prices go down. I think our horses, if you take out La Crenelle, there's one horse, Stallion Heiress, who looks really fast. Our trainer ran against her a couple times in New Orleans to watch those races, and she's a extremely talented filly. And I would say if La Crenelle's out, you know, she's definitely the horse to beat. And I think after her, I think most of them are pretty competitive on the sheets, you know, and on the form. A filly, she won, then she won. First time against winner, she won, and then first time in a graded stake, she hit the board. So she's progressing. We raced the mother. She won stakes as a 4-year-old. So I think it's a good chance to take a shot. Is she going to win? I'd like to think she can, but she would obviously have to take a step forward. But other than La Cornell and Stallion Heiress, they all have to take a step forward to win. So I like the spot, and you know, see what happens.
I have a couple of follow-ups for you, Craig. You brought up a bunch of interesting things there. We're talking, for those who don't have the form in front of them, we're talking about number 11 emphatically here, who is the Glen Hill runner in this spot. When you are handicapping a race where you have a horse in, is the process of looking at the race any different than when you're just handicapping a race to make a bet? Or is it the same process and the stakes are just higher for you individually?
Yeah, I mean, the stakes are obviously way higher. I think when you have a horse in the race, you try to figure out a way that you can win and see if your horse has the running tactics to win a little bit. I mean, I'm 215 pounds, so I'm not riding any races, but you like to try and figure out the best way for your horse to run versus the horses that are in there. And if you have a versatile horse, if your horse has a running style, you know, you don't want to take him out of that running style against good horses. But yeah, I mean, I think our horse, she should be forwardly placed. She's got to go from the outside, and you know, she should be, you know, laying the Stallion Heiress is going to go to the lead, but I mean, she should be right, you know, laying second or third. And, you know, I think, that's how I'd like to see her run. So it's a little bit different. It's a little bit different process than if you're just handicapping the race purely from a betting proposition. A lot of times you look at a race and you say, man, this doesn't look like that tough of a race. And then you put your own horse in and you say, man, there's seven good ones in here. So it just kind of depends on the race.
That's a great answer. I think you nailed it. I mean, the question of perspective, the second point you brought up, and then the first point you brought up to me, the way it sounds to me is it's a question of how you design the race. When we're looking at a race to make a bet, we're trying in our mind to design the whole race, figure out who's going to be where, who may be advantaged or disadvantaged. But of course, when it's your horse in the race, you're trying to look at the race and design the way that your horse can win. You worry more about, you don't have to worry as much about everything else going on around you as you do to sort of narrow in. I think it makes perfect sense. The other follow-up question I wanted to mention, you talked about emphatically's Dam Indy Groove. Do you find in your handicapping in general, at least when you're assessing your own horse's chances, that knowing that kind of information about the female family, expecting which of your horses are going to, you know, maybe hit the ground running and that's what they are versus horses who are going to improve as they go on in their 3-year-old year and maybe improve as a 4-year-old, is that something that becomes part of your handicapping process as well?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it helps us manage our own horses maybe a little bit better. You know, you as you start to, you know, manage multiple generations of families, you start to know the traits. You start to know what to look for in the ones that can run. You know, but most of the horses in this particular race, you know, they're well-bred horses, and they're trained by people that know what they're doing. You know, so I would say from a handicapping perspective, you just have to look at the race that's going to run. I think the breeding is important from an overall management of the horse's career perspective. But I mean, each race you go in and you see where you stack up.
It makes perfect sense. Jonathan, what are your views on the Edgewood?
Yeah, I think this is one of those races where, considering the weather we're going to have, I don't know what they're going to do with the turf tomorrow, But on Friday, you would think they're going to probably keep most things on the turf. They'll probably take the rail down for the stakes starting on Friday. And I would assume that the inside is going to be the best place to be. It's going to be the grass that hasn't been kind of chopped up. And I think it's going to probably be the footing you're going to want to be on. So for me, I want to try to find a horse that's going to be there. Obviously, Stallion Aris has a great shot of getting there on the front end. And Bernadiva has a shot of getting there and kind of sitting that pocket trip. I'm not crazy about Bernardini's on the turf, but this horse has run really well in her last two starts. And obviously, there's a shot with her saving all of that ground on the inside and ran okay on a yielding surface. First time she tried turf as a two-year-old. So I'm going to try to identify when I design this race after scratches and all that stuff, who's going to get down to the inside, because I feel like that's going to be the part of the grass you're going to want to be on after they take those rails down, considering the weather.
JK, if you were on Team Oxley Cassie here, which of these two, Dream Dancing or La Coronel, would you run in this spot?
Oh, I'd run Dream Dancing here and La Coronel and the other one, right? I mean, it's, you know, especially where La Coronel drew. I wouldn't want to start her from way out there. You know, I don't know where she's going to draw in the American turf, but, you know, who do you really fear in there? Obviously, the Windstar horse that had the awful trip in the Breeders' Cup, I think is expected to be in there and would probably take a lot of my money. But, I like the sporting aspect of running La Coronel on the American turf and running Dream Dancing here.
Well, we'll be talking all about the American turf and all of the Derby Day undercard stakes and are giving our final thoughts on the Derby. We did a quick run through of the Derby on the last show we did last week, if folks want to go to that. Otherwise, you can tune in. You can join us live through the magic of Spreaker at 11 a.m. tomorrow, or you can catch us on the archive wherever you get your podcasts a little bit later in the day tomorrow. Gentlemen, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. I think that's should be a good amount of time, not to go fully in depth, but at least to give our thoughts on the featured event of the day, the Kentucky Oaks. Jonathan, you haven't gone first in a while. This to me seems, I think I can predict who you're going to like in here. Getting back to that same old thing about the horse with the best form and numbers potentially having a pace advantage, but we'll obviously leave it to you to give your selection for this year's Kentucky Oaks.
I think there's only four horses that can win this race. Paradise Woods, Feral, Miss Sky Warrior, or Salty. Outside of that, I don't think any of the other ones have a shot. I actually, one of the best things about hanging out at the racetrack is just hearing different people talk about different ideas. And someone brought up a great point this morning that Paradise Woods, it is Mandela, and we all know what kind of a horseman he is, but it's going to be 50 and probably rainy and wet. And do you really want to take 4 to 5 on a horse who's spent most of their time looking up at the Eddie Logan suite? Like, I'm not sure I really want to do that. I'm leaning to the 10, Miss Sky Warrior. You know, I think that her race in the Gazelle was pretty impressive. The pace wasn't slow, and she opened up and improved her position going a mile and an eighth. And for whatever reason, the Paradise Woods doesn't take to the beautiful weather here in Louisville. I think Miss Sky Warrior is one that could pick up the pieces at what should be a fair price, considering the amount of money that Paradise Woods is going to take, Feral and Salty.
I feel like you buried the lead a little bit in there. You're in danger of having to turn back in your Baffert wig. You basically just said Abel Tasman, number 13, can't win, didn't you?
I did. Luckily, I'm gonna wear the wig for American Freedoms. And then I'm going to have I got these guards with white gloves set up. I'm going to give them the wig. They're going to take it back to the hotel. And then I'm going to watch the race.
Fair enough. Craig, what are your initial thoughts on this year's running of the Oaks?
I thought it was a funny move when Miss Sky Warrior left Gulfstream because of, she had been training there, but obviously she had the form at Aqueduct. She's been pretty impressive as she's run. I like the other horse Jonathan mentioned, Salty. Her race and her progression, it's the races are basically the same quality and the same timing as the favorite. The favorite obviously ran a wild race that day. I thought that Abel Tasman was maybe against it that day, switching bonds, switching routines, switching everything, switching riders. If Paradise Woods is a dozen lengths faster than Abel Tasman, I mean, she's probably going to win this race, but I would expect her to regress a bit. I think Abel Tasman probably will run better than she did last time, but I think that the best horse in the West Coast was obviously Unique Bella. Champagne Room was a great 2-year-old last year. She won the Breeders' Cup. I just can't imagine all the good 2-year-olds were in California, and the rest of them were just spread out around the country. So I think that Salty, she was super impressive. I was at Gulfstream that day, and I would stick with her today or tomorrow on Friday.
I like it. I like it. Yeah, for me, I don't know if I can get over just how eye-popping Paradise Woods was. You guys both make good points about the possibility for regression and all the question marks. But I think for me, in my multi-race play at least, she's going to be at least worth half of my tickets, mixing in some of the others. And I think you guys surrounded the right ones. The adding blinkers with Abel Tasman is an interesting one. I haven't done any digging in Formulator. I'll be doing that. But is that part of why, do you think, does that give you a little bit of pause, Craig, at all, when you see a horse making an equipment change like that in a grade one?
That's a funny situation, because she was, it's not often you see a horse win a grade one at two, have what's defined as a comeback race, run great against Unique Bella, who is always thought to be a standout, and then switch trainers. I mean, Baffert runs a lot of horses and blinkers. He likes his horses to be more forwardly placed. He trains them faster, and you know, he wins a ton of races that way. So, I mean, I think it's just getting her more into his program. Simon Callahan is a good trainer. But they're not, they're probably not asked to do the same thing every morning that Bob's are. And I just think, you know, she got beat 12 lengths, and, you know, she couldn't get the lead at any place. And that was in a small field, and now she's going to run in 14 horse fields. So she obviously needs to be, unless they break bad, you know, Bob's horses, they're normally not, come from behind horses. So, you know, obviously Arrogate did it, and I remember the horse in the Haskell a few years ago, Coyle did it, but they broke bad. I mean, his horses, if they're going to be competitive in big races, they need to be forwardly placed. That's how they're trained, and I'd say that's why she's in blinkers. So I think it's a positive, if anything.
Makes sense. JK, you mentioned when this barn switch was announced a few months ago that you worried about whether or not Abel Tasman, with her established running style, was going to fit into that Baffert program that Craig just did such an excellent job describing. Do you feel like you were correct in that prediction, that maybe this is a case of trying to fit a square peg into a round hole?
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe you can eventually make it fit. But I'm not going to find out at 5-1 on this stage versus these types of horses. It feels like it's a little bit too fast, too soon. You know, and like Craig said, I mean, not even think about it. The rider change, the morning change, the routine, the barn, the location, the style, and now the blinkers. It's just a lot of changes going into the biggest race of her career. And it's not something that I want to experiment with at what's probably going to be a less than desirable price.
Yeah, and if she's going to get aggressive, it could hurt my case on Paradise Woods and help your guys' case on some of the closures in the race. Be fun to continue to take a look at this race. We've got some time to finalize our opinions, but we wanted to get on the air today and go over this undercard and the Kentucky Oaks, and I'm glad we got a chance to do it. We're just about out of time now. I want to thank Jonathan Kinch, and I especially want to thank Craig Burnick for joining us today. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. Lots of Derby content this week. The site, drf.com, chock-a-block with great coverage from our top team of reporters. I'm going to be back with shows, handicapping sessions, we're calling them, Wednesday night at 7. That's tonight at 7 if you're listening live. I've got Jay Privman and Craig Milkowski aboard talking Derby. Tomorrow night, the legendary Andy Beyer and DRF's national handicapper, Mike Watchmaker. That's going to be from 7 to 8 tomorrow. You can look for marquees on the site to sign up with those. And then tomorrow, 11 a.m., are we ready to announce our guest, JK? Who do we got tomorrow?
Well, we might have lost one of them. There might be a West Coast travel conflict. We're going to try to get Duke Matisse, but we might think we're going to lose him because of travel. And Nick Tamaro, I think, is a strong possibility, as long as Travis Stone doesn't have him running too many crazy errands this week, trying to get Travis ready to call his third Kentucky Derby.
Well, whoever it's going to be on there tomorrow, it's going to be a great show. We'll be back then. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. This is the DRF Players Podcast. May you win all your photos.